Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on the part of the world you're calling in from. My name is Pavi Mehta, and I have the pleasure of being your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call today. Today, our special guest speaker is Elle Luna, and I have the pleasure of introducing her now. Elle Luna is an accomplished designer, artist, writer, and movement leader, working at a series of groundbreaking companies, IDEO, Uber, Mailbox, and Medium. Elle Luna has been at the forefront of design innovations that millions of people around the world use on a daily basis. Her gifts as a designer allow her to powerfully reimagine the way people use technology, and it eventually catapulted her on an uncharted adventure of reimagining the way she uses the ultimate gift, life. Today, she's an acclaimed multimedia artist and writer based out of New York Beach here in California. Her book, The Crossroads of Should and Must, grew out of a blog post and sparked a national conversation. As she continues to live its quietly revolutionary messages, she's being steadily drawn into a new calling around reconnecting women from around the globe with the much-needed power and balancing force of the feminine principle. Today, she is channeling her energies into a movement called Aphrodite Emerges that seeks to awaken women at the individual and collective level everywhere and to inspire them to inhabit their inner wisdom and innate gifts. When you consider the span and reach of her work, one can't help but be impressed. Elle Luna has made a mark in the world and then some. Her most celebrated contributions are tucked invisibly into the design of apps that make our daily lives more connected, intuitive, and seamless. But her greatest contribution, perhaps, is the way she lives her life as an open-hearted invitation, an invitation for everyone, everywhere, to become conscious designers of their highest potential and to let their gifts sing together. It's a joy to have her here with us today. Thank you for being here, Elle.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Elle, let's jump right in and get started. I was thinking we could start with your origin story. Where did Elle Luna's story begin? If you could tell us about the roots of your life. When you look back, what were the influences and events that shaped who you are in definitive ways?
Well, I guess the early origin story would be that I was born in Dallas. I was born in Texas. And I grew up, I spent the first 18 years of my life there, and I went on to study in Tennessee and Nashville, and while I was there, I felt like I should follow the footsteps of my father and my grandfather, who were both incredible lawyers. My father still is. And so I went to college thinking that I would become a lawyer. And an interesting thing happens when you find yourself saying one thing but doing something very different. I found myself, you know, studying for all of the rigorous exams for law school, but basically sleeping at the art studio because I was creating all of these projects and, you know, was so wrapped up in what I was creating. But the bridge between those two worlds, for some reason, I couldn't quite see it. And I don't think I ever really wrapped my head around the possibility that maybe I had been called to live a creative life. And so I applied to law school, and in a great gift from the universe, which I didn't see at the time, it was very painful, I was rejected from every law school that I applied to. Yeah. And I think that my admissions essay, the story must have the readers of my essays must have really been able to see what I was saying in the roots of that essay, which was, you know, don't let me in, don't let me in. And so it was a tremendous gift, because in the face of failure, which is how I perceived it, a new door opened, which was, well, I sure do seem to love making art. And so I quickly, my adventure began. It took me to Chicago, where I began studying visual communications, and I got my master's degree at the Art Institute of Chicago. And it opened up this entire world for me, which was very innate, but for some reason I couldn't quite, you know, make it conscious. But I just really wanted to live in the world of images and visuals and the creative spirit of play. And so that, I guess that would be, and of course, you know, as a child, I would paint and draw all the time and, you know, would make things. And I think I just innately saw myself as a creator. And I believed that it was, you know, maybe this thing that, you know, being a creator was reserved for kids, that was kids' play. And I don't know, you know, I can't think of anything anybody said to me, you know, I don't recall anything my parents ever said to me that made me think that, but I just had this feeling that, you know, once I grew up, I would have to put the paints away and, you know, become an adult. And that kind of playful child spirit would have to take the back seat to a different type of life. And I guess when I realized that actually maintaining that child spirit into my work, when I realized that that was possible, it was, you know, a lot shifted internally.
Wow. I can't help but, like, be curious to ask, like, what is the first thing you can remember creating as a child and feeling, like, the sense of pride in the act?
I painted a portrait of a woman walking along the edge of a lake, and she's wearing a beautiful dress, like head-to-toe dress. And she has on these, you know, fabulous glasses. They weren't sunglasses, they were seeing glasses. And she's carrying this beautiful parasol above her head. And it's bright sunlight, and she's passing in front of these beautiful red flowers. And behind her is this gate, this big gate with a big monogram, you know, like the family name on the gate. And behind that is a large home. And it was a home in my neighborhood that we would pass by when we were at this particular lake. And I painted this, and my mother saw it and immediately declared it an absolute masterpiece. You know, took it right from my hand, and she had it framed, and she had it, you know, with a beautiful mat that went around it, and she hung it right on the wall. That, you know, it was fresh off of the, you know, fresh off the floor. And there was something about that she just said, "This is complete, and it, you know, and it's important, and it, you know, it's there's something here," and she had it framed. And there was something about that experience where I realized that there was something about art that was really important, that it was touching on something that maybe we could, you know, see or feel, but, you know, maybe not explain or fully be able to make sense of.
Wow. And how old were you at that time, do you think? Like,
I don't know, maybe 6 or 7, I'd have to ask my mom.
Wow, that's such a special origin story of the artist. There you go. It's like, that's the moment when you realize what art could be and what it could, or kind of the impact that it has too, right? Like, just seeing the effects that your work has on another heart can be so powerful. It reminds me, I was reading this Rumi poem recently, and it just comes to mind with your work, and kind of the journey you've been on. And it's a really short one. It says, "If you want what visible reality can give, you're an employee. If you want the unseen world, you're not living your truth. Both wishes are foolish. But you'll be forgiven for forgetting that what you really want is love's confusing joy. And
wow.
that element of, you know, kind of that play that, and that bewilderedness and that creativity, that place where the unseen and the seen, the visible and the invisible kind of intersect. I feel like you've sort of danced along that line in your work. And I wondered, like, what are there any, it seems like your mother was a deep influence, but are there any spiritual or like inspirational figures that have been important for you?
Well, I'm looking at my desk right now, which has like sort of like I built like a little I don't know if it's a mood board or an altar for like sort of the spirit of what I wanted to make sure I brought into the call. And so maybe I'll just tell you what's sitting on my desk.
Perfect.
I have a beautiful book by an artist named Mayumi Oda. She practiced here at Green Gulch at the Zen Center here in Muir Beach. And she is an incredible artist who has been working with goddesses. When she became pregnant with her first son, she just had this urge, this, you know, inexplicable urge to paint these full-breasted images of these women doing all kinds of wonderful things. And she took a lot of the male god imagery of her childhood growing up in Japan and turned them all into female deities so that they would, you know, resonate with her in her life. So I have Mayumi Oda's work, and I have a volume of Mary Oliver's poetry. I love children's books. I have a copy of Lemony Snicket's book. He collaborated with John Klassen, and they wrote a book called The Dark, which is just marvelous. I love it. Let's see, what else do I have? I have a book called The Book of Symbols, and it's a compilation of all of the, well, I shouldn't say all, it's an attempt to look at symbols and archetypes that we experience throughout our lives, and it's built on the work of Joseph Campbell. I would say Joseph Campbell has been one of the more largely influential figures in my life. I'm also thinking about just favorites, Siddhartha, and I'm thinking, I guess when I really look at influences on my life, I think there's a lot of inspiration that I find in art and in people who try to communicate their inner transformation through music or poetry or just sort of the, you know, that world in between, which I was talking to a girlfriend about a year ago, and she said to me, she said, Elle, I learned the most interesting thing. And I said, what was it? And she said, well, I learned that when a caterpillar goes into the cocoon to become a butterfly, do you know what happens inside the cocoon? You know, and here I am, like we're walking on the sidewalk in San Francisco, and I'm leaning forward thinking, you know, she's about to tell us, like, that's the answer. Like, she's about to give the answer, all capital letters. And I'm leaning forward, like, waiting for this message to be delivered. And she says, the caterpillar becomes goo. And she just kept saying it, goo. And I thought, what a marvelous, nonsensical, you know, like you're trying to communicate, you know, what is it like when you're in a goo-like state? Well, it's impossible. It's like in Alan Watts's book, The Wisdom of Insecurity, he talks about he had a strong desire as a child to he wanted to send a parcel of water in the mail. Hmm. And he talked about wanting to fill up a box with water and wanting to send it through the postal system. And there's this wonderful, like, kind of absurdity about, you know, it's how do we talk about inner transformation? Because it's just goo. But there are all these artists and writers and children's book authors and poets who have given it a go. And it's like, how do you talk about that thing that you can't talk about? I guess that would be the most, those folks have been the most intriguing to me.
Quite a collection there, and just such a rich story. I was thinking as you were talking about how, you know, that putting words to the indescribable, or just even noticing those things that other people are just kind of, you know, walking by. I think it's such a, and taking for granted. I think it's such an inherent part of what being a good designer is. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to that part of your life. I know you spent 5 years with IDEO, and your contributions in the design world are tremendous in so many ways. And what are the kind of principles that have been key for you as you approach that world or look at that world with the designer's eye?
When I was a designer at IDEO, one of the very first things that I learned as a junior designer there on learning about the user-centered design process was they talk about how they talk about the process of brainstorming, which I'm not sure if IDEO came up with it, but they did come up with a series of rules that they held as sacred for if you want to go into a really creative, generative space. And these kind of rules have stuck with me for you know, ever since. And some of the rules are to encourage wild ideas. Hmm. To defer judgment, one conversation at a time, to stay on topic, and to build on the ideas of others. And I remember, you know, as a young designer, hearing these and applying them to our creative process and the projects that we were working on. And I have to tell you, it's really, really fun when you have some ground rules, but then you can go into this emptiness, this space, you know, pathlessness, you know, and it's, you're coming up with, you know, oh, and make it visual. That's another rule. Everyone has a post-it notepad and a mm-hmm. Sharpie. And the reason that we would do that is because if you use a pencil, the line is too thin and it encourages you to write small words and letters.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use a Sharpie, it almost forces you to create more gestural, more synthesized marks because you don't have that much space with a Sharpie. So we would get, you know, thick markers and small notepads, and that combination would inherently require distillation of the idea. And you would basically just have a pad of paper and a pen. And, you know, one of the first things people say is like, but I can't draw. Like, I'm not creative. I can't even draw a stick figure. And because we would do this with our clients. And these are, you know, folks who maybe never thought of themselves as creative. But at IDEO, I think we all had this similar ethos that everyone is innately creative and that we're all creative as kids and that anybody can draw. And, so everybody would get a pad and a pen, and we'd have one kind of facilitator ask a question, and then everyone would just sketch. And the spirit of a brainstorm is fast, and it's so much fun. It's really, really fun. And when you have people, you know, we were trying to design an insulin injector for folks who have diabetes, and one of the ideas, I think it was one of the individuals who was leading our office at the time, he said, you know, I know how we're going to get the insulin inside of the person's body. We're going to put scuba divers inside of the insulin pen. They're going to be very tiny, and they are going to take the insulin and swim it inside of the individual's body and put it into their bloodstream. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, this guy's in charge, and he's talking about scuba divers and insulin pens. And I thought, you know, defer judgment, defer judgment. And it, the minute that happens, when you realize, oh, wait, like, anything is possible here. And you think, like, okay, where does that take me, scuba divers in a pen? And then right after that, someone else had an idea, because what he did was, like, kind of shuffle around the blocks in our mind. And that that humorous post-it note that he created opened up a wall for someone else, opened up a window for someone else. And the idea that they came up with ended up being breakthrough for how we were delivering insulin in this device. And I learned in that process that if we can take that process into life, into this playful spirit and building on the ideas of others and just one conversation at a time and bringing it into this playful child spirit, the generative effects are exponential. Now, of course, I think that the other half of design, which also has really stuck with me, is that there you can kind of think of a project process in two phases. The first is to be generative, to cast the net wide, to, you know, take the nut that you're trying to crack and expand it and open it and, you know, read and collect and talk to people, research. But then you get to an inflection point where you decide, okay, now we need to narrow, we need to focus. No more additional things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like when you're cooking, like, okay, we have all the ingredients. Now we need to just play with what we have. And that's also really important. And that's when you begin to refine and remove and edit and distill. And, you know, it's like when you're cooking a soup, you're distilling the flavors, you're really ripening the broth. And then the last piece I would say about the process is that in one project, you might go through that expansion and contraction many times. So it's almost like a double helix, you know, turning in on itself. So it's not exactly linear, but it does have forward momentum.
That's so interesting to hear it described like that. I think just yesterday I was listening to this interview with the late Celtic poet John O'Donohue, and he was talking about how we tend to dwell in a world of facts and forget the world of possibilities. And facts are distilled possibilities. And if you can play with more possibilities, your distillation becomes a lot richer. I was thinking that seems like that inbuilt into your process was playing with the possibilities, scuba divers and all, and that enriches the distillation so deeply. And
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, it's such a tricky...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's tricky to figure out how do you get outside of your own, I would almost say, limiting thoughts.
Hmm.
There's a scientist named David Eagleman, and he studies the brain. He's a neuroscientist. And he talks about a fish swimming underwater, and he talks about how do you communicate the existence of the water to the fish. It makes no sense because it's their entire reality. And he says that when a fish sees a passing bubble float by, it's a clue, it's a hint at the larger reality that is beyond that which the fish can see. And I think as creators, we're all trying to ask questions of, you know, what are the bubbles floating by? How do we talk about that? How do we talk about, you know, the existence beyond, maybe what we can touch and see, and that's our immediate reality. It's tricky.
That's kind of profound, and it just like kind of begs the question of, for you, like, how, what has have been ways in which you've been through that process of kind of like identifying the bubbles? Like, how do you where have you begun to see that in your own life?
In dreams, I would say that's been a wonderful bubble, a series of bubbles. Remembering dreams. For a long time, I had dreams but would forget them. You know, I would wake up and, mm-hmm. you know, hop on my phone and already be somewhere else. But beginning to listen to my dreams and take time to remember them, write them down. I have on my phone, I have a audio recorder, and in the morning, what I do is, and I don't dream every night, well, I guess technically they would say that we dream every night, but that we forget most of our dreams. Mm. But on days when I wake up and the dream is still very close to the surface, I will reach for my phone and record. I'll just hit record on my audio recorder, mm-hmm. and I will recount the dream while I'm still half asleep, mm-hmm. and really try to bring the vivid details to the surface. You know, it's not just that it was a yellow light, but, you know, what was that yellow like? And, you know, to say that it was almost like the yellow of bones, mm-hmm. You know, or that the room had a glowing quality. But what does glowing mean? You know, to really try to unpack and move the camera around inside the dreams. And then after waking up and, kind of beginning the day, it's sort of a process to return to those images, which are so, they're just like these unmitigated stories. They're these, everything is allowed in our dreams. Everything is invited in. It's all there, and at times it can be messy and chaotic. At times it can be very crystal and clear. But it's just this unbelievable openness that's flowing through in the dream world. And the challenge for me has been, you know, if dreams are the voice of the body, how do you take that really important next step, which is making sense of the dream? Because just to have it might just send me walking in a circle, but to sit down and take a good look at what those colors or symbols might mean. And that's where I go to that book about the Book of Symbols, the Joseph Campbell anthology, and also look at, you know, just what does yellow mean to me today? Because maybe it is different from years ago. And then in those details and in those symbols, beginning to use them as I guess, like a map, an internal map that is being revealed to me about where my journey wants to go or is having trouble going, if I'll only listen. So dreams, remembering dreams is a really powerful tool.
And I know you've had a really vivid experience with the white room, and I think many of us have read about it in reading your work and other interviews with you about this recurring dream that actually manifested in your reality, and for the, which is a tremendous story in itself. But for many of us who may not have that kind of relationship to our dreams, how do you begin to even filter the signal from the noise in your experience? Like, is there a special quality where you know, or the or that you sense that this is important, and you know, and the family, you know, other things might just be the surface mind kind of recycling some impression.
Yes, well, I once heard an amazing author and poet. Her name is Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She once said that if in the morning you want to see your dreams, but you're having a hard time connecting to them, to say out loud, "Show me my dreams." And I just giggled when I heard her say this, and I thought, like, that's so silly. Again, you know, I'm hearing my designer mind, like, defer judgment, defer judgment. But I'm sitting here thinking, like, I have to say it out loud, you know, into the morning sky, like, show me my dreams. And you know what? I tried this trick and it worked. And so I don't know what it is, but there's something about, I guess it is about stating the intention. And like, if there's something that you really would like to receive an answer to in your dreams, or something that you, maybe someone who you would like to connect with in your dreams, before going to sleep, you can state that intention. And I've often had this feeling with dreams that in my own life, in my own experience, whatever I was looking for or seeking was in some way looking for me too. And there's just a feeling that there's some divinity in that, in those kind of tugs and those draws, those feelings that we have that draw us to something, that there's a greater intelligence there. And I once heard, I don't remember who was talking about it, maybe it was in a book. It might have been in a book called The Kin of Atah, which is about this entire culture that lives in their, they have a community built on dreams. And my wonderful friend Susie recommended this book to me. And in the book, they talk about two types of dreams. There's sort of the personal dream, which is, you know, working out the everyday stuff, which might be more related to our immediate everyday life. And then there are what they call the big dreams. And the big dreams are the ones that are a part of the larger collective unconscious and are dreams that are shared on a very deep level. And this particular group of folks, this is a science fiction novel, this particular group of folks believe that the big dreams are shared, and the dream world actually connects us all at a very deep level. So I would say deciphering between the dreams, you know, is this about just maybe my own, like the white room, for example, the white room from my dreams, I believe was a larger, deeper dream, and it was a space of emptiness. But in that emptiness was everything. And it was a space of total peace and stillness, and it was out of time. And I just sat there in this empty room. And when I share this story, I often hear other folks talking about this need for this blank space or this empty space. And it begins to ask questions, you know, what does this emptiness do for us? Why do we feel so called towards, you know, a blank page in our notebook, or a new roll of film, or, you know, what is it about, like, the beginning of the week? This kind of, there's both trepidation, right? Like, oh gosh, you know, it's the very first page of the journal, and, you know, what if I use the wrong pen color? Or, you know, there's sort of this fear, you know, how do you approach something that is with this emptiness? And then there's also this excitement that anything can happen, that every possibility is available. That's why dreams become, especially when they're the larger dreams, when we share them with other people, they begin to kind of weave threads between all of our journeys.
What's coming up as you're talking is just how it seems to help in becoming more sophisticated in our patterns of interpretation, or more conscious even in how we're interpreting. And when I think about it, like whether we do it with our dreams or not, we're constantly doing it with our reality. You know, what does so-and-so did this to me, or this event happened? What does it mean? And it seems like there's so many layers to how we can understand and how we can interpret. And we maybe sometimes tend to get locked into particular cycles that are maybe not the deepest or the truest. You know, just seeing things as they are is such a hard thing to do. And having a practice that kind of almost what I hear in this kind of way of interpreting or interacting with dreams and reality is almost like a game or a playfulness or like it's an adventure that, you know, you're on, and that I guess has this effect of enlivening you to the process, you know, as opposed to just kind of sleepwalking through it in a way. And I feel like that's another thread in the kind of work that you do, is this really, you know, through your design work, through your art, through the 100-day project, just inviting people into just even asking that question, like, what is my dream? What is my, you know, greatest gift? What is my greatest joy? How do I want to show up in the world? And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what the 100-day project, kind of what role that's played in your journey and what it sort of revealed for you.
Of course, yes. The 100-day project is I don't know if you can hear it, but I'm smiling over here. It's a really fun project. It started about 3 years ago. I had heard about this designer, an amazing designer and author. He lives in New York. His name is Michael Beirut, and he had started a class at Yale titled The 100-Day Project. And every year he would do this class where for 100 days you would pick some action. He called it a design action, and you would repeat it. And the only rules to the game were that, see, I'm calling it a game, were that you had to document every instance of 100, and on the 100th day you had to share your project with everyone else who participated. And, you know, I don't know how the mind is such an incredible mystery to me, because I think I learned about that class in 2003, and it was maybe 2013, 10 years later, I was walking down the street, and it was like the loop closed in my mind, where I thought, I don't have to be in Michael Beirut's class to do the project. You know, how do those things happen? Yeah. It's just so inexplicable. And I was with friends at the time, and I said, would anybody else want to do this? And why don't we just do it on Instagram? And it was this, you know, of course, everyone says, you know, oh my gosh, my schedule for 100 days of this serious commitment, and I'm busy and I'm traveling, you know, and which raises a lot of interesting insights about our culture of busy. And we sat around talking, and, you know, I thought, oh gosh, you know, nobody's going to do it. And, you know, should I just do it on my own? And one of the guys in the group, he said, you know, that sounds so cool. I totally want to do it. And after he said that, everyone else was like, okay, I'm in. And we started that year, and we just put it online as an offering, as just sort of anybody can play. This is kind of the rules of engagement, and let's all start on this one day, and let's all do it together as a community. And it swelled into this incredible, the word that's coming up is just like this life force, because you were watching all these people doing something that excited them, And it was like this beating heart of work that was just flowing online. And there was this one woman who lived in Kansas City who she was a mother of two boys, and she had in her bio on Instagram, it said, wannabe artist, but for real mom of two. Mm-hmm. And after she began the project, she was doing these incredible watercolors. And after she started the project, she blossomed with her work. And at the end, when we became good friends, and I wrote her a note and I said, I think it's time to update your bio line, because you are a for real artist. And it felt like, you know, there was a man whose daughters decided that they wanted to experiment being vegan. And so he thought, okay, if they're going to be vegan, I need to learn some vegan recipes. So he did 100 days of vegan cooking. And every day he would post, you know, the results from the jury, you know, how they felt about what he was cooking. And so it wasn't just drawing or crochet, although they're amazing projects. Mm-hmm. There was also, this year, someone did 100 days of LGBT cuties. And it was these incredible portraits of the LGBT community with stories about who these people are and why they are so amazing to this artist. And so, yes, I could wax poetic about this for a very long time. There's something about sitting down and saying, okay, inner artist, okay, inner child, what would just be so cool? And can I do that for like 30 seconds a day? Can I commit to 30 seconds or a minute or 5 minutes? I mean, the best projects are the ones that don't take an hour every day. The ones that, you know, they say, I'm going to design a poster every day for 100 days, but I have to do it in under 5 minutes. Those are the ones that really take off. And you can watch people, you know, set aside this time. And at the beginning, and maybe this is true more with the creative process, or I guess when I think about other projects I've worked on, the beginning is always exciting, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, you're so thrilled about the project. You have your fresh journal. You have your sharpened pencils. You know, it's everything is glittery and sparkly and fun. But then you get to day 31, and you've run out of good ideas. And you are suddenly, like, tired of this project, and, you know, trying to find 5 minutes is really a tall order, and, you know, things are beginning to fall apart. And you can see in people's projects when they, you know, the direction they thought things were going, you know, begins to come to some sort of a culminating end. And I have to say that's the moment of the project where the really beautiful things happen. Because when that happens, you see the person, their commitment to the project, mm-hmm. their commitment to the process, and just this larger understanding that they're committing to the full race, you know, not just the start line, but, you know, mile 13 when your legs are aching and you say, like, I am going to keep going. And when you watch someone, you know, run out of quote unquote ideas is when something shifts in their process, and you can see it in these projects, and it's incredible. It's incredible. You know, maybe it's a whole new direction, or maybe they see something in a new way, or maybe they just, in my own experience, realize that they have the capability to take something all the way through to completion. And when you realize that you have that kind of endurance inside of you, it's, you know, it's just a little project of 30 seconds a day or 5 minutes a day, but over time, what you might learn about your process or about what you're excited to do, what you think is cool, or even just your own ability to stick with something, even if it's hard or even if it's even if you don't see the way forward, just to say, I am staying with this. I'm going to take it all the way. It's really powerful.
So much of this part, I mean, it's just seeing the little that I have seen online of it, it you know, kind of excites. It's just impossible to see it and not feel like, oh wow, like you want to be a part of it, which is, it has this igniting quality to it. And I think about, you know, the other igniting spark that you put out there, one of the many in the Crossroads post that turned into a book, that turned into kind of this national conversation on the crossroads of should and must. And with things like the 100-Day Project, with things like, you know, kind of that question of what is my calling, in your experience now and having had so many conversations like this over time, how do you respond to, first of all, what are the biggest roadblocks that people kind of come up to you with, and, you know, reasons for not being able to move forward, and has your response to them changed over time, or has your own understanding of those blocks and like what how people can best interface with them, like is that a shifting kind of perspective that you have on that?
Well, I would say the biggest question that I get asked, I guess there's, there's a lot of questions that get asked around, you know, how do I connect to my must? Or, you know, what if I don't know what excites me anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to create a 100-day project, what would it even be about? Do I even know? Am I connected to that child spirit inside of me? This sometimes the kind of the voice of reason and the voice of safety and the voice of continuing to do things the way that they've been done, the invitation to go into a brainstorm where, you know, scuba divers could deliver insulin is so foreign. And it feels like this sacrilegious invitation to just do something that sounds cool and has potentially no purpose. It's like the author Julia Cameron, in her phenomenal book, The Artist's Way, she says, she recommends that everyone take their inner artist on a date once a week. Now, that's a great way to reconnect, to reconnect with your inner artist. And it's sort of like, you know, if you just tune in and say, you know, what am I craving right now? What am I longing for? And it might surprise you. One time my inner artist said, I would like a new wardrobe. And I think my inner artist was craving colors. I think my inner artist just wanted to go to India and buy beautiful saris, actually. And I think there was something about wanting to wear flowing dresses and beautiful colors and things that sparkled and shimmered that I was really craving. And so I took myself on a date and I went to the fabric store. I couldn't afford a whole new wardrobe, but I could afford to, you know, maybe get a couple bolts of fabric. And, you know, other artist dates that I've gone on, one time I wanted to go for a ride in a really fast car. I just went with like a convertible with the top down and just like to feel the wind. Or dance in the rain, that's been one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a tendency to say like, well, you know, but what does that get you, or where are you going with that? And the answer is you just don't know. You don't know until you go and do it. But if you follow that urge, if you follow whatever it is, you know, maybe it's a beautiful tool, like a special pin, or maybe it's just to sit in the sunshine, or you know, to go into a place of worship during off hours, whatever that might be. If you follow it, there's a treasure there, or there's a thing there. It's the body again trying to say, I have all of these messages, if we'll just listen to it. And I guess the other side of that coin would be the practicality of living a life, you know, sort of rooted in this artist brain. That's so cool all the time, right? The my own logic brain comes on and says, but we've got to keep a roof over our head and we have to pay the bills and, there's laundry to fold and, bills to pay. I can't just be off playing in the rain all the time. And one of the things that I discovered was that I was watching a TED Talk by a designer named Stefan Sagmeister. And in it, he talks about three different types of work, a job, a career, and a calling. And he says that a job is something that we typically do from 9 to 5 for pay. A career is something that we do over time, and we also get paid. And a calling is something that we do for intrinsic value. It's regardless of payment. And what was really revolutionary, in my mind about this talk was that he was essentially showing me that if I became aware of which of these I had in my life, the work that I was doing as a designer was, what was that? I think that I was sort of silently in that work thinking it was a calling, but really I think it was more of a career. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I wanted to make more time for my calling, but I was so exhausted, at the end of the day or on the weekend, that I didn't really have much emotional space to really dive into painting and making art. And so I realized that I needed to kind of shift some things. And people throughout time have combined how they make money with their calling in really different ways. I guess the thing I'm beginning to look at more and more is, how do we optimize our life, for the calling, and make sure that I mean, I think of a calling as something that comes from your heart. It's something that comes from, it comes from a place of love. This thing that you have to do that, no matter what, it's like Van Gogh, the whole world laughed at him, but he continued to paint the world the way he saw it because he just knew he had to do that. I was just reading about this incredible doctor in the Congo, and I should know his name. I can look it up. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize because he has been working with rape victims in the Congo, and the government and society and all of these people are saying, this is not to do this. And he says, we have to help. Mm-hmm. And he's been, that comes from this place of his heart. If he wanted to be safe, he would certainly have a different profession. He's been, his life has been threatened. He's providing physical help. He's providing psychological help. He's created an incredible world for these victims to heal. And that's what he says, I do it because I have to. And so when we look at our calling, it's like, how do we figure out how to sing for our supper, or make sure the bills get paid, because unfortunately money is the way that we have to on some basic level work on this planet. And there are brilliant people who are coming up with new models, and I want the whole world to be looking at service space and this life of service that's rooted in something different. But for anyone who is wondering, how do I pay the bills? I would say that just because you want to pursue your calling does not mean that you have to quit your job. And just because you do something for money doesn't make that work dirty. There's dignity in all work. And the exciting thing where I get into more of the playful mindset is, how do you want to combine your job, your career, and your calling? And actually, if I can read something from the book, there's an interview with the composer Philip Glass. And he talks about how he balanced his work and his life. And he said, while working, I suddenly heard a noise, and I looked up to find Robert Hughes, the art critic of Time magazine, staring at me in disbelief. "But you're Philip Glass," he said. "What are you doing here?" It was obvious that I was installing his dishwasher, and I told him that I would soon be finished. "But you're an artist," he protested. I explained that, yes, I was an artist, but that I was also sometimes a plumber as well, and he should go away and let me finish. I love that story. And I there's also, I mean, there's an incredible book called Daily Rituals. It's about sort of the morning routines or the daily routines of artists. And it talks about how all these different people made their kind of their calling work amidst a busy life or, you know, a series of obligations. One of the stories I love is Toni Morrison. And she worked, she had two jobs that she worked Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. She was an editor at Random House. She raised two boys. So maybe she had three jobs. She was an editor at Random House. She raised two boys. And she was a single mom. And she also taught university classes. And she said that she pursued her calling in her, quote, in-between hours. Mm-hmm. And I love this idea that the calling doesn't have to be, you know, we don't have to get on an airplane and go to a faraway land to finally write our masterpiece. Like, it just doesn't seem to happen that way. It happens in the in-between moments. A man came up to me after a talk, and he was really upset about this idea of having a must, and that we all have one, and that we all have innate, unique treasures inside of us. He was very frustrated, and he said to me, "I think that's great, but it's not practical for me and for my life." He said, "I have 5 kids and a mortgage. How am I supposed to find must?" And I thought, well, that's a really good question. I better think really fast. And, you know, because how do we do it? And I asked him, "Do you have 10 minutes? And he said, "Yes, I have 10 minutes. And we brainstormed where he might find those 10 minutes. And he said that, you know, maybe he had a couple of minutes as the shower was warming up before he hopped in the shower, or maybe he had a couple of minutes while he was waiting for the tea kettle to boil, or, you know, he found these little pockets of time all throughout his day. And it's a little bit like the 100-day project. If you just carve out 10 minutes a day, and not just a, you know, sort of psychological space, but also a physical space. I would say if you're on the call right now and you're thinking about this passion that, you know, has been sitting in the sidelines for what you're wondering is maybe far too long, I would say find 10 minutes and find a space, and not, you know, the corner of the dining room table in between meals. Find a real open space, something that's inspiring. You know, maybe it's a park bench in a garden that you love, or a spot at the library that's just for you. It's like Virginia Woolf when she talks about the importance of a room of one's own. Having that space, that solitude where we can hear ourselves speak, seems to be a prerequisite for anything to come forth. And maybe that's, you know, ultimately what the White Room was all about. I don't know.
Thank you for that answer, Elle. This is Rahul, one of the other hosts. And, we're actually at the just past the top of the hour, and I wanted to actually open the queue for the other folks on the call who also have questions. And I know that Sunny still has a couple, but for folks on the call or live stream, if you've got a question on the call, press *6 to get in the queue. And from those listening around the world on the live stream, you can send your question to ask@servicebase.org. And when it shows up, we will just ask that question to Elle. And actually, we do have one already on the web form, which is from Robert Diaz in New York. He said, "Hi, Elle, I love your book, and I keep it on my desk. And since taking your Skillshare class on recording your dreams, which I also really enjoyed, I wanted to know if your recurring dreams about the White Room continued after it came to be in reality. Do you have any recurring dreams at the moment? Thanks, and keep being amazing.
Wow, thanks, Robert. Hello in New York. How incredible that we're all around the world connected right now. Isn't that just amazing?
It's beautiful.
Well, Robert, I think it's very serendipitous that you just asked that question, and here we are talking about service, because I had the recurring dream until I found the room in real life. When I found that white room, I stopped having the dream. And maybe it just transitioned from the sleeping domain to the waking domain. And the only other time I have returned to the white room while dreaming was the night before the 100-day project began last year, when I committed to painting my dreams for 100 days publicly. And on the night before the 100-day project began, I returned to the room. So I'll walk into the dream with you now. I returned to the white room, and I knew it was the same place, but it was no longer a box. It was no longer like a cube. It had transformed from a cube into a, it's almost like all the walls opened up and rotated. And it almost looked like a blossoming flower. If you can imagine just all of the walls opening and unfolding. And I began walking into this labyrinth of these walls, almost like walking around inside of a flower. And the quality of the walls was beautiful. You know, I've always talked about the walls as glowing. And it's almost as though there's light inside of the walls. And I decided to go and examine the wall. And I got up to the wall, and I noticed that all of the walls were made of tiny snowflakes. And as I walked around inside of the space, I realized that this was no longer my room. It was no longer just for me, and I had this deep understanding that many people had lived in this room and that it was a place where many people would continue to live. And the snowflakes on the walls were representative of all of the people who were creating the white room in their own way.
Wow.
And my hunch is, Robert, that there's something about when we follow our intuition, or when we follow our creativity or our dreams, this voice of the body that somehow seems to know where we most deeply want to go, that whatever that is shared on some level, and I think it ultimately guides us to each other. And I think it ultimately connects us to everyone, and that source is shared. And that when we follow our must, I don't quite, this part's a little fuzzy for me, but that when we follow our must, it's ultimately to be in service and to take those gifts and to share them, because we never know who's out there just waiting to receive exactly what we feel called to give. Thanks for asking, Robert.
Okay. I was saying that we do have another question in the queue, and I'm just going to unmute that person right now.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I've listened to these calls for quite a while. This is Nikki in Delaware, and I didn't realize I'd be in the queue. I'm so choked up by that vision. Sorry. Oh, it's so great to connect with you today. I didn't know about you, but I'm so glad that I discovered you. So much of your story resonates with my life, although I'm near 60 now, and I deferred my creativity for many years. I was a single mom too. I worked as a legal secretary, and I stuffed my stories into drawers and drew my little caricatures, and then I got sick. And like you say, there's always a blessing in every event. And the blessing was I had time now. And our income went in half, but we made it. My husband has been my patron of the arts in a way. And when my grandchildren were born, there was this beautiful gush of creativity that came. And I started to create for them and write songs and create little books and things. And so when you started talking about 100 days, oh, just another gush just came. You know, I just can't wait to start this because I know that giving a commitment like this can change your life. And because when I discovered Service Space and KindSpring, I was really in a dark place. I just committed to a year of gratitude, and it grew into a beautiful group of people that I just adore. And it just grew into this place of healing. And so I just want to thank you for that. My question after that is, how did you facilitate the group? Did you, I think you mentioned Instagram, but did you have a group on Instagram? I mean, did you specifically put aside a group, or was it open for everybody?
That's a great question. I first want to just say it's amazing to hear you talk about your creativity. And when you say that your stories were stuffed in drawers, I thank you for having the courage to share your story so vulnerably, because there are, I have a feeling there are a lot of stories stuffed in drawers around the world. And for anyone who's hearing this, you can, it's like there's a vibrating quality to your voice right now that is like, I can feel you're almost like your heartbeat. I can feel your life and what you're saying and how passionate you are about it. And for anyone who also has stories in drawers, you're probably getting them. They're scratching their heads too right now. And so thank you for sharing. The group online, it's open to anybody. It's just a group of folks. We all kind of sign up at the same. We start on the same day and we end on the same day. We do it once a year. But a lot of people do it on their own. You can just, if you begin your project, we recommend, you know, announcing your project to other people and putting out a call and saying, does anybody else want to do it with me? Because it's really fun to do it with other people. And you can organize your post by putting the hashtag, which is the ampersand sign. And then after that, writing the 100 day project. So THE 100 day project, all one word. And if you put that tag on your post, it will automatically be connected to everyone else around the world who's also doing projects.
Okay. Thank you so much, Elle. Just thank you for everything. This is a beautiful call, and I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. It's also interesting to hear she said she was in her 60s. And I'm recalling that sometimes people say, you know, like I was at a dinner a couple weeks ago and I heard a young man in his early 30s say, oh, I'm too old to do that. I'm going to leave that to the young designers. And it really made me laugh that, you know, we're never too old. The time is never too late. You know, Laura Ingalls Wilder, she wrote Little House on the Prairie when she was 64. And like the chef Julia Child, she didn't even find her calling in food until she was in her late 40s. I think Mastering the Art of French Cooking came out when she was in her early 50s. Even IDEO, they just hired a designer in her early 90s to help them look at designing for end of life and designing for the elderly. And she's incredible, and she's bringing so much wisdom and knowledge to that that company, and she's going to touch products all around the world. So it is never too late to honor your must, to honor why you're here.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. We're moving to the next question.
Hi, Al. My name is Kozo. I'm calling from Cupertino. And thank you so much for this inspiring conversation. A lot of times during the call, I was reminded of the artist Sark. I don't know if you know who Sark is, but she uses these, you know, these bold lines, you know, like it's more like a marker than a fine pencil. And she has this childlike quality that comes out. And it reminded me, I have two sons. One of my sons is 9. One of my sons is 6. And my 6-year-old, he still uses crayons, right? So he makes these bold, you know, big, thick drawings and stuff. And my 9-year-old, they're inventing new pencil sharpeners to make the pencil as fine as possible. And everything has to be super precise. We're talking about Cupertino School District, which is a really crazy school district. But everything has to be so precise and so, you know, fine-lined. And I'm wondering, how do we keep that big, bold child art marker in our children's hands and hearts when the, you know, their educational system, you know, the computer programs that they're doing, and society are taking it away from them. I mean, literally taking it away from them, in that our art program was cut due to budgets.
Thank you, Kozo, for calling in and for the question. I mean, your boys are very lucky to have you for a dad and to be asking this question. It's a terrific question, and I think it's one that we've been struggling with for a long time. I believe it was Picasso who said that every child is born an artist. The trick is to how to maintain that once we grow up. And in my own work, what I've really come to experience is that a lot of the creativity in my own life was wrapped up and connected to my understanding of the feminine. My understanding of the role of creativity, not just, you know, for fun, but in the world, and the expression of creativity, which can, in my own experience, has also been very healing. And this the role of the feminine as it exists, not just in women, but in men too, and in connecting to our feelings and connecting to those big, bold drawings. Feeling like we can embrace the fullness of our experience. And at the beginning, there was mention of some work that I'm doing with my dear friend Susie Herrick around, we're leading a workshop called Aphrodite Emerges. And it's all about returning to looking at the goddess culture that used to be everywhere on the earth. And I'd love to just read this little passage, because this is how I'm looking at it and kind of where my work is leading, but this is how I'm looking at your question, which I think is really big. This is from Mayumi Oda's book, Goddesses. She says, "Millenniums ago, goddess culture was on the earth. We women were the sun and truly the creators. With the progress of civilization, God became stronger than goddesses. God became stronger, and goddesses were suppressed to the level of society's unconscious. Goddesses have had to sleep for thousands of years. Goddesses are inside of each of us. My friend Peter Levitt, pointing to his legs, said, 'These are the legs of goddesses.' I want all of us to have the legs of goddesses to firmly root us to the earth. Earth is crying for her recovery." So I think about these, I believe there's a connection between this this feminine energy and the wisdom of the feminine principle, and how we reconnect to that, not only as women, but also as men. For your boys, how do they stay rooted in a life where they can continue to express themselves in these beautiful, pure ways, which you're watching and you don't want to lose? And I guess it's a larger question It's a great question, and I don't know the answer. I hope we can figure it out soon, and together. Which is how do we maintain the wisdom of the feminine principle and the wisdom of the masculine principle, and how can those be in a partnership of equals and balance, so that we have the full intelligence operating from the minute we're born and being manifested not only in what we create in our classes, but also the types of businesses we build, the types of messages we put out into culture, the way that we build communities. Because I think that when half of the population is outside the door, we build things differently. But when we include everyone, we bring everyone in, we take those walls down, we have that that intelligence begins to multiply and amplify, and I have a hunch that we'll be drawing big, bold paintings.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for that, Elle, because I haven't heard that aspect of it brought up in terms of preserving the arts and education, but it just occurred to me, because I have two sons, I come from a family of all boys, that, you know, honoring the divine feminine, or just honoring the feminine, is such a major blind spot in a lot of boys' upbringing. And so, taking this call into consideration, I think I'm going to do a 100-day challenge where I'm going to drop 5 minutes of divine feminine into my son's lives every day. So thank you so much.
You are my hero. There are people all around the world right now who are smiling because of what you just said. And that's beautiful. I love it. And if you do this project, if you document in any way, I would love to follow along.
Thank you so much for the inspiration.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next question.
Hi, Al. This is Alexandra calling from Washington, D.C., and I'm so inspired by what you're presenting and what you're saying. And I lived for a time in the Bay Area, worked in the technology industry, and there was so much hope that the technology industry would be kind of this massive creative disruptor, which in some ways, obviously, it has been. But in other ways, it's kind of fallen back into some of the old patterns of industry and business. And I wonder, just listening to you, given kind of your celebrated roles in these companies, how do your friends in the Valley, what do they think of what you're doing, and kind of how do you respond to the ethos of the Valley?
I don't know what they think of what I'm doing. But I would say for anybody who's on this call who is in the technology industry or who touches someone who is, how we take the best of the miracle of technology, and how we're able to network, and how we're able to connect, and how we bring the values and principles into it, and we make sure that they are in there. I would say, building on the dialogue that Kozo just began, making sure that if you're building tools that are serving men and women, make sure that half of your team is women. What we don't want to see is, you know, having young men, boys, you know, in their late teens and early 20s, designing products that are going to touch everyone in the world. Because we want to make sure that, you know, there's also, we're honoring all parts of who we're designing for. And or that when we are beginning to think about how, who's going to be using this product, that we not only just do what we used to call me-search, which is what would I want, what would I need, but we do true research that's representative of the group that we're looking to serve. My collaborator Susie often talks about San Francisco being feeling like being in the center of Rome. You know, we are. It's truly a place where entire worlds are being built here, and there's a great responsibility that we have to do that in a way that expresses our values. And so I would say, if you're on this call, get in there, meet with teams, share your opinions and your thoughts, and help and build, because I have yet to meet an HR team that that doesn't want to bring in more voices, that doesn't want to have their products be more reflective of what's really happening and you know, being inclusive. I was just at a dinner a couple weeks ago led by an incredible leader within Silicon Valley, John Maeda. He was the president. He led the MIT's Media Lab for a number of years. He was the president at the Rhode Island School of Design. He recently worked at a venture capital firm here in Silicon Valley, and then he just left to go start on a new venture. And he hosted a dinner, and the entire topic was inclusion. And he made sure that half of the dinner, it was about maybe, I don't know, 40, 50 people, half the dinner was women. And throughout the dinner, he made sure half the people who spoke were women. I was just recently at a political rally where the speakers on stage, it was a rally for Hillary Clinton, and the speakers on stage specifically said, "Is there a woman with her hand raised?" I think that's it. Is there a woman with her hand raised? What do the women think about what we're doing? What do the women think about what we're building? And I truly believe that if women are included in the conversation, I think that it will change everything, what we're building, why we're building it, and how. And so I would say, if you really want to do something innovative, if you, which every entrepreneur does, right, they're looking for the ultimate creative act. They're looking for that thing to bring into the world that hasn't been built yet. If you're an innovator, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a creator, the most innovative thing you can do right now is to include women. Include their voices, and I think it will change the entire trajectory, not just of your team, but of Silicon Valley, and because that's touching the world, I believe we can literally create an entirely new world simply by making sure that women are at that table.
I couldn't agree more, Al. Thank you so much for that. As the other host on the call, it's my privilege to ask you the last question, which is, what can we do as a community, as a broader service-based community, to serve your work in the world?
Wow, what a beautiful question. I wasn't expecting that. Well, maybe I'll read a quote from the book. I think this would be how I would respond to that. It is a quote by the philosopher Howard Thurman. This would be my ask. He says, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." I would say figure out, spend 10 minutes today, carve off a little bit of time, go sit in the sun or run backwards or skip or take a nap or laugh until your belly hurts. Do something that that just sounds exciting, something that you've been craving. Maybe it's more joy, maybe it's slowness or stillness. Maybe it's just doing something that has no purpose whatsoever, like sending a parcel of water in the mail. Just follow that in one small way today for 10 minutes. And that would be my ask. That would be it.
That's brilliant. It's also a quote that we're very fond of in the service-based community. So thank you so much for that. We are actually at the end of our time together, and we like to end the call in a similar way that we started, which is with a minute of silence, but this time in gratitude for all of the conditions that have brought us together, the sort of seen and unseen people, including the many folks behind the scenes who have made this space and this morning possible to just learn from your journey, Elle. Thank you so much. I have unmuted everyone on the call, and so we like to do this fun little thing to end where we just on the count of three say thank you, Elle. So with everyone unmuted, we will go ahead and see how that cacophony works. One, two, three. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much, Elle, and we look forward to having many more interactions with you, and for all those on the call, looking forward to seeing you on future Awaken calls. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.